So we're continuing our study of Sefer Shoftim, and we had just started Perek Ches. We're in the middle of the reign, if you will, of Gidon HaShofet, who just led a very successful military campaign against Midian. What we're going to see today is that it was not yet complete, and he had a desire. He had a desire to totally eradicate Midian from having any power, and it, to some degree, you would think it's similar to the story in terms of the cycle that we've been doing, in that the previous Shoftim Havoso, they kind of complete the job before they almost retire into the sunset, if you will. What's going to be fascinating about Gidon as we shift through Perek Ches and Perek Tes is it's going to be the first time that we have some form of legacy. We'll see that if it's positive or negative, but some type of legacy in terms of their own children that we have not heard about from the previous Shoftim. And, you know, we could try to glean hints throughout, perhaps, as to why he might have been unique in that regard. So we had read the first three psukim, which were like a standalone story of the people from Ephraim, from Har Ephraim, and the men from Ephraim, from the tribe of Ephraim, who complained with anger against Gidon as to why they were only called in late in the battle. Like, why weren't they invited to be part of the fighting force? And we had pointed out that Gidon deals with them in such a peaceful manner, showing a true aspect of leadership. And again, judging the situation as is, and he basically says, he starts praising them to the extent that he totally diffuses the situation. And the last pasuk we read was that, you know, they were all they were totally at peace with him when he spoke to them, and we could give have a better understanding in terms of comparing and contrasting that story, which shows one aspect of his leadership and ends with a certain positive outcome, together with the next story, Pasuk Dalet, which is where we're continuing from today. Vayavo Gidon Hayardena. Gidon comes to the Jordan, he comes to the Yarden, the Jordan River. Over hu ushlosh meos ha'ish asher ito. He crosses, over who? He goes over. Ushlosh meos ha'ish asher ito. The original 300 men who are with him, who he brought into battle to be victorious, the ones that were kind of brought down to that group, in the sense that it started with 32,000, then down to 10,000. Hashem said, no, I want a select group. Hashem wanted to magnify the miracle. They're with him. So even though, and you almost have to have parentheses around the pasuk, because even though subsequent to their initial victory, more people joined the fight, including the people from Ephraim, they're back to that force of just 300. Ayefim, they're tired. Virodfim, they are chasing. And there's something quite admirable about that phrase. Ayefim, virodfim. Ayefim, we understand why they're tired out. They've been involved in a military campaign. Virodfim, they didn't allow themselves to stop. They're still chasing, as we'll see. Gidon had this desire, perhaps it's divinely inspired, but a desire to do away with Midian totally so that they cannot rear their heads back and come back and take control over the land. And they're not, at least this initial group, they're not letting their tiredness be their excuse. They're still actively chasing. But they are tired. And it's only natural that if you're tired, you can run out of your provisions, even though we had mentioned before that they kept the provisions of those who had left the camp. Apparently they had run out. Pasuk Hey. Vayomer la'anshe Sukkos. So Gidon turned to the people of Sukkos, and Rashi makes sure that we know Anshe Sukkos, these were Yisraelim, these are Jews. Sukkos is a town, a specific town. And he asks the following, Tinu na kikaros lechem. Give now, kikaros lechem, loaves of bread, la'am asher beragloi, to the people that are at my feet. Ki ayefim heim, for they are tired. Va'anochi rodev achrei zevach v'tzalmuna malcha Midian. And I am going to be chasing after Zevach and Tzalmuna, who were two kings of Midian. So we have the mission. The mission is to try to get these two kings, because again, when you knock out the leaders, you knock out the people. And at this point, and basically it sounds, as we'll we'll be soon able to kind of put a tie a ribbon around the story of this war. This was the last piece that needed to be solved. These two kings had to be captured. If these two kings were captured, that would be indicative of the war totally being complete, mission being accomplished, peace being achieved for all of Israel. They were kings of Midian. Their names are Zebach and Salmunna. Now, he's asking for provisions. He's asking for kikros lachem, loaves of bread. Bread is the staple of life throughout most of history, definitely in Tanakh. His people are tired. There is an aspect of humility. We keep seeing Gideon's humility in many variations. Here we see it in the sense that he's not even asking for himself. He's asking for his men. Ki ayefim heim. He almost sounds like he is running on some superhuman strength because he says, they're tired. V'anochi rodef. I'm continuing to chase. I'm not giving up. But I need to ensure that for my men to eventually come along with me, perhaps, that they need to be satiated and they need to be nourished. And he's turning to Sukkos for help. And it's extremely surprising because we have to kind of frame the request. This is not a random person coming and asking a town in Israel for help. This is an individual who had just led a fairly miraculous battle that was a tremendous success. Until now, we just know that Yisrael won, Midian lost. Pretty soon, in about four or five psukim, we're going to get the casualties from the side of Midian in actuality, the numbers. And it's astounding as to how successful Klal Yisrael was able to be, again, with initially this force of just 300. So it's almost like, how could the people of Sukkos possibly say no to such a request? And he's not even asking for himself, he's asking on behalf of his men who are tired. Even if they weren't owed any sense of Hakaras HaTov, you would maybe expect some type of kindness. Unfortunately, the response to the people of Sukkos is pretty horrific. Pasuk Vav. Vayomer Sarei Sukkos. The officers, the leaders of Sukkos say as follows. Hakaf Zevach V'Tzalmuna Ata Biyadecha. Sarcastically, they say, is the palm of Zevach and Tzalmunna, these two kings of Midian, is it already in your hand? Ki nitein litzva'acha lechem, that we should be giving your legion, your group, bread? And there are two ways we can maybe try to at least understand what they were even saying. Were they maybe saying a concept that we don't owe you anything yet. You didn't do anything for us yet. Meaning, in this current mission that you're going to do, you didn't succeed in it yet that you should deserve sustenance or to get food. Or it's some line of the, you know, and in that regard, we see the people of Sukkos in an extremely negative light. Because where is their Hakaras HaTov for what has come before? And where is their sense of brotherhood? Even if you want to say they won't have Hakaras HaTov, how do they not help a brother out? So the other, it could be they were rotten. It could be that they weren't good people, at least the leadership of Sukkos, and we'll see what happens to them as a result. The other perspective may be is they may have had a fear. They may have had a fear of this Zevach and Tzalmunna, almost to saying, have you captured them that if we provide you food, we won't be held accountable. I mean, there is a concept that if you help someone's enemy, you become part of the enemy. Meaning, let's say Gideon is not successful. Let's say Gideon these kings of Midian are able to be victorious against Gideon. They come to further power. Are they not going to come back to Sukkos and hold it against them? Almost, you know, we have, you know, fast forward in Tanakh. That's what happened when David and his men, a little bit bigger than this, David had a group of 600 men, needed to provide them, and he came to the city of Nov, Ira Kohanim, and he asked the Kohen Gadol for provisions. The Kohen Gadol went ahead and gave those provisions, but unfortunately, one of Shaul's servants was there. His name was Doeg HaAdomi, and Doeg went ahead and ratted out the people of Nov to Shaul, and Shaul eventually destroyed the city of Nob because they helped out his quote-unquote enemy, they helped out David. And so there may be a sense, a kind of excuse that the Anshei Sukkos, the Sarei Sukkos, the officers of Sukkos, the leaders, could have. But when we see the totality of the story, it appears that they would have been in the negative, they would have been in the wrong, even if that was the case. Because at this point, Gideon is the shofet. Gideon is the leader, and the leader is asking something of you, and your job is to listen to that, in the sense and furthering in the sense that up until now, and going forward, Gideon's been working within the prism of the Dvar Hashem. He's a messenger of Hashem. He's fighting the fight of Hashem, and you'd have to imagine that he's continuing to fight. Even in the previous dialogue that he had with the people of Ephraim, he mentioned Hashem, how Hashem gave you. Hashem is all over his words. For intellectual honesty, you could have maybe, you know, he could have maybe said in Pasuk Hey, where he stated his mission, he could have maybe thrown in a phrase that I'm still fighting the fight of Hashem, which he didn't. Now it could very well be that he did say something about Hashem, and we don't have it in the pasuk because we don't necessarily have word for word exactly what happened. But the men of Sukkos, they basically say no, and that's taken very hard by Gideon. Pasuk Zion. Vayomer Gideon. Gideon says back to them, Lachain. Therefore, so here he gets religious again. Baruch Hashem. Biseis Hashem ezevach v'tzalmuna biyadi. When. And it's not if, because there's no part of, you know, even that you would almost say that Gideon who we saw in Perek Zion, the Gideon who needed to be like extra convinced, and Hashem said, okay, you know, you should go now to the camp. Okay, you don't want to go right now. If you want to go get a sign, you know, you'll hear that dream that was happening. The Gideon that was not necessarily fully confident in himself. And that he's the one selected by Hashem, so that Gideon doesn't exist anymore. This Gideon, this is the one who is super duper successful. This is a Gideon who is a shliach of Hashem. And so he says, Lachain, therefore, biseis Hashem as Zebach v'Tzalmuna biyadi. When Hashem gives over these foreign kings, Zebach and Tzalmuna, into my hand, bidashti es bisarchem. I'm going to, it's an intense language, thrash your flesh. Es kotze hamidbar, with thorns of the desert, the es habar kanim, and briars. Thorns and thistles, plants that are could be used as weapons. The dashti from the word disha. Disha means to thresh. So when you're the Metzudas David explains it a little more. Metzudas Tzion just says the dashti miloshon disha, which is threshing. In his Metzudas David, where he explains the pshat a little bit more, so he says ke adam hadash tvua. When a person threshes grain, what happens? You're smashing it, right? The grain is you have the chaff on the outside of the kernel, and you need to try to break it apart. So there's a lot of like smashing going on. So basically, Gideon says, "I'm going to smash you." You're physically going to be punished in the sense that, and some will understand how is Gideon allowed to make such a threat. So the Abar Benel and others explain an idea that many of us are familiar with in the context of a melech, in the context of a real melech, a real king. So the Torah has a whole Parsha Samelech in Sefer Dvarim and in Parsha Shoftim. There's a concept of having a melech, and part of having a melech is the melech rules. There's a rulership of the melech, almost like there's a alternative method of law, that we have regular Shulchan Aruch, the four books of Shulchan Aruch that we have to deal with, and then a king has his own system of law, the Rambam describes it, where if you're Moreid B'Malchus, if you rebel against the king, Chayiv Misa. It, from a Torah's perspective, it's like those olden days of off with your head if you're rebellious to the king. There's a concept of the king being almost in the place of a middle a middle person between the nation and Hashem. In the same way, we need to have strict allegiance to Hashem. We're supposed to have strict allegiance to the king. And if you're married by Malchus, you could be Chayiv Misa. Some aspect of that can be borrowed to the Shofet, whether it's an exact carbon copy. But the Shofet, in that position of leadership, being morayed against the Shofet, is really a crime against Hashem. And Gidon, therefore, it's within his right to kind of threaten the people. And when you carry that forward, you know, again, using his language, this is going to happen. He doesn't say if Hashem causes me to be successful. He says b'seis Hashem. When Hashem gives over the two kings into my hands, you're going to be punished. And you could ask the question, why does he deal with the previous story, which was the people from Ephraim? He deals with them so tranquilly, so peacefully, trying to appease them. And here, he's attacking. He's being defensive. So I think we... Correct. So the people of Ephraim came to Gidon with a complaint, and Gidon kind of dealt with it. Here they're coming. Here Gidon is going to them. One of the differences I think we could highlight is when the people of Ephraim come to Gidon, they're complaining about Gidon. To Gidon, you made a certain decision. Here it's about his men. Here it's about not helping Klal Yisrael. It just happens to be that Klal Yisrael, in this point, a representation of Klal Yisrael is these 300 soldiers. But they're a representation of the people. If you have members of Klal Yisrael that don't want to help other members of Klal Yisrael, that is the Shofet's job to deal with. I mean, that would be in the time that you have a melech, you would have the melech dealing with that. It can't be that you do whatever you want. You could do whatever you want when there's no law in the land. But when you have a sense of rulership, when you have some type of leader, so there needs to be proper leadership. And so he's, on the one hand, it's on behalf of others, not on behalf of himself. And on the other hand, there's this aspect of you need to have a functional country. The functional country, you need to have citizens taking care of their fellow citizens. If not, what is it? And it's not a Torah society. A Torah society is the king guiding v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, is guiding that there should be the law of the Torah should be the law of the land. And clearly saying no in such a situation is just wrong. So at this point in terms of why did he select Sukkot, as it must be that he was near there, on his way to the Yarden. It must be he's on his, you know, that, or it's after he crosses over the Yarden, and this is kind of the first town that he's coming across. And the Radak even says that the way that he made his threat about using these thorns, it could be that you know, it seems like a little bit of a unique threat. Why that as opposed to lashes with a whip or you know, whatever, you know, fill in the blank, you know, punishment. It could very well be that these were the local plants. And one of the reasons why it was called Sukkos, Sukkah is a language of protection, is that the town itself had to have forms of protection from these plants and from these, you know, their natural habitat involved these kotzei hamidbar and bar kanim. And he says, you know, almost like you think you have your own protection, and that's going to be a theme in the next pasuk as well. I'll kind of show you that you need our protection, you need us, and therefore you need to have this, in a certain sense, a reciprocal relationship, because in a nation, that's what it's about. These men will go and fight, and these men will provide the food. These men will do, you know, these men will, and you know, that goes back to everyone having their role to play, goes back to even a different actual battle against Midian in the desert when Moshe Rabbeinu fights against Midian. So that particular battle involved an interesting setup in terms of how to draft the army. It wasn't all hands on deck. It wasn't like a milchama against Amalek where it's like everyone. It was specific. It was a force of a thousand men from each tribe, and another thousand men from each tribe were kept for some type of spiritual goal. And the way the Midrashim and the Gemara explains it is that 12,000 soldiers and 12,000 people davening. And almost like the two together, the people davening needed the people with the swords, and the people with the swords needed the people davening. That in Klal Yisrael, they're different divisions of the Tzivos Hashem, of the army of Hashem. And here, in this instance, Gidon was having 300 soldiers be the active, continuing Hashem's plan of being the active soldiers, but they needed sustenance. And so he was turning to the people of Sukkos as a partner, and they denied him. He goes one more, Pasuk Ches, Vayal Misham Penuel. He goes from there to Penuel. Vayidaber Aleim Kazos, and he spoke to them like this, meaning he made a similar request of Kikros Lachem, of loaves of bread. Vayanu also Anshe Penuel, the men of Penuel answered back, Kasher Anu Anshe Sukkos, just like the men of Sukkos, meaning they said no. Vayomer Gamla Anshe Penuel. So now Gidon says to the people of Penuel, Lemor, saying as follows, Bishuvi Vishalom. When I return in peace, right? So that's almost, you could almost understand that phrase as a little bit of a summary. Because if it's true that the people of Penuel answered similarly to the people of Sukkos, it must mean they said something along the lines was, well, have you actually conquered the two kings who you said, right? That sarcastic line of, is their palm already in your hands? Are you ready in control of them? Well, if you go fighting against two kings and you come back in peace, usually it means that you're victorious. That if not, if you go to war, there's two options. Either you win or you lose. And that if he said back to them, Bishuvi Bishalom, when I return in peace, Etotz es amigdal hazeh, I'm going to break this tower.
I would think that at this point he's wondering, he's going through all this effort, and these are the people he's saving. It's like, what an ungrateful.
Right, what is Gidon thinking? What Gidon must be thinking in terms of, you know, he's now 0-2 in terms of turning to the very nation that he's trying to save, and this is why would he want to continue? Why, you know?
Like the continued lack of Luna and Hashem, because if they can't believe that he would be successful in this after winning with just 300 men. They haven't learned it.
Right. Well, you know, where in terms of what is the spiritual state of the people at this point? You know, one of the things that and maybe you scratch your head a little bit in terms of the story of Gidon, we haven't had a major focus on the religious development of the people. Now, clearly they were deserving. Clearly they must have done some form of sincere tshuva, at least a good percentage of them, because A, Hashem sent them Gidon. B, the battles are overall being extremely successful. And the story is going to end in the similar manner of, well, there was peace in the land for all those many years. Meaning the same way the story ended when Devorah did lead the tshuva movement and the different, right, and the different shoftim led a more clear tshuva movement. When you hear about the Ruach Hashem resting upon the shofet, it's a little bit absent here. And so the question is, let's say, in this kind of the case study of Sukkos and Penuel, where were their religious beliefs? Where's their Amunah and Hashem, as you were mentioning? And maybe you would also say that to some degree, we would like to believe, although it's not always this way, we would like to believe that when a person follows a full Torah lifestyle, so they're also a mensch. Right, they're also right. We would like to believe, and the Torah definitely has the potential for that, of derachah darchei noam, that the ways of the Torah are pleasant and sweet, and that if you follow the dictates of the Torah, including not worshiping idols and believing in Hashem and all of those basic things, that will make you the type of person who A, has hakaras hatov, B, recognizes the notion of kol yisrael arim mazav zeh, that every Jew is responsible for another, which these towns are not having. Maybe it does speak a little bit to their spiritual state, that they weren't as committed balei teshuva as maybe we would have expected them to be at this point, or maybe Gidon expected them to be at this point, and yet it's not really addressed. Are they just the outliers? Is it not necessarily indicative of Klal Yisrael? The Pasuk mentions he threatens them by saying etot es amigdal hazeh. I'm going to atotz, to smash, netitza, to destroy es hamigdal hazeh, this tower. So apparently they had a tower. So you have to start with that. That they had a tower, and as some of the Mepharshim explain, they put their faith in their tower. Their trust. And that they didn't need Gidon because they have a tower. And Gidon basically says, well, when I return in peace, I'm going to destroy your tower to show you that it wasn't your tower that's keeping you safe. It was Hashem. And it's us. It's Hashem's army that's theoretically keeping you safe. It doesn't mention if he finds any provisions at all. You have to imagine that he did. Because his men are, or unless you understand some type of miracle, that even though he's going, he went 0-2, he was able to find something because the battle's about the aspect of the battle is about to begin. Pasuk Yud. V'zevach v'tzalmuna b'karkor. Zevach and Tzalmuna, the two kings of Midian, were in Karkor. Umachnehem imam kichameshas asar elef. They had a camp with them approximately like 15,000 soldiers. Kol hanosarim mikol machane bnei kedem. This was the leftovers, the survivors from the people, the camp that was of the east, meaning when they were set up in Eretz Yisrael proper before the initial battle. V'hanoflim, those who had already fallen in battle, me'ah v'yasrim elef ish sholeif charev. Mea the Esrim Elef, 120,000 ish Sholev Cherev swordsmen. Now, there are times in Tanakh where we have large numbers that are exaggerations, and I imagine it's possible to read this pasuk literally, that there, what had been, happened was 120,000 soldiers had been killed, and there's perhaps a way to read it that it is an exaggeration, but you know, they don't. You don't give an exaggeration like that if it's not something close, if it's not something real. And we kind of start putting numbers in terms of the victory that we saw in the middle of Perek Zion, where again it was kind of that fake battle of blowing the shofar and smashing the jars and attacking a surprise attack and then creating the sense of confusion and then Hashem inspiring a spirit of soldier fighting against soldier, and then they're on the run, and then you add in other armies from the tribes actually coming and joining. So what was the total of that? According to the text, 120,000 swordsmen had already been killed. So the two kings of Midian are left with the remnants. Now, on the one hand, the remnants still sound like a lot. 15,000 sounds like a lot, and we know how many Gidon has. Now, the other person, technically, if you're keeping score, you would say, well, 300 was able to take out 120,000. So, of course, they can handle 15,000. And the truth is that, as Gidon is saying, he's still fighting the fight of Hashem. When you fight the fight of Hashem properly, it doesn't make a difference what you have with you, right? We go back, we have Avraham Avinu with the war with the kings in Parshas Lech Lecha. According to one approach in the Medrash, he just had his servant Eliezer. According to another approach, he had 318 soldiers. Still, it's quite a small force going up against multiple kings and their armies. But he's Avraham Avinu. He's fighting with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's Rabin Biyad Ma'atim. The many can be given over into the hands of the few. And maybe we would also say is that, and I don't necessarily want to read too much into, right? When you translate the word nosarim, so the strict translation of nosarim would be the leftovers, those who are left. Happens to be, maybe, what does your translation have for nosarim? In the middle of Pasuk Yud 10.
All that were left.
So the art school gives a little color to the translation, which is sometimes, you have to like think about it, because it's not the strict translation. It's where they get that from. The art school says all the survivors, and that there could be an aspect, while they do have a force of 15,000, they're all licking their wounds. They're all these they have a certain type of you know, yes, they survived the battle, but they, you know, to not to downplay it, they probably have, you know, ancient form of PTSD from that. The fact that, so many soldiers had just been killed, that their comrades, their friends, their commanders. So while they have a force of 15,000, we're going to see that Gideon is choosing wisely to attack, and that their 15,000 may not have been a 15,000 who are confident and strong or believe in themselves. So that, you know, there may be something again. I could be reading into it a little bit in terms of that translation of leftover versus survivor, but we can understand, and maybe that's why right here we're hearing about that. Why should we be told about those who have fallen in battle here? Why does that add significance? It adds significance because now we may see what's the confidence level that they have, knowing that, you know, percentage wise, they're, you know, there's a approximate math here, but we're talking about, it's like 10%. 10% is left. You know, we use the word decimate the wrong way. Apparently, officially decimate means to take away one-tenth. To take away one-tenth. That if you would, in ancient battle, if you were successful, you were able to take away one-tenth of the enemy's force, you decimated them, I think. Because it has the word deci in it. Here it's the opposite. Basically, Klal Yisrael took care of 90%. And maybe that's why we're being told that here.
So, what did they use? They used swords, and what they had, swords, knives. What did they use?
Well, the soldiers were described as swordsmen. One would imagine that they had all sorts of weapons, but it's not spelled out here. It happens to be that they were described as a certain way. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Vayal Gideon derech hashuchunei ba'aholim. So Gideon goes up a certain path. He goes up the derech hashuchunei ba'aholim. Who are the shuchunei ba'aholim? So Rashi explains that they're some type of nomadic people. Sheroim mikne tamid. They're constantly shepherding their sheep. The Ein Darim Babatim, they don't live in homes. They live in tents. They're like the nomads. They're like the Bedouins to some extent. And so it's not the habited place. So the Derech Hashchune Ba'olim, Mikedem Lenovach V'Yogba, to the east of Novach and Yogba, which are places. And therefore, this was a type of sneak attack. He's not taking. He didn't come to where they were in Karkor, on the main road. He came the back roads, and so there's an element. That element of surprise attack. Vayachas amachne. He strikes against the camp. Vahamachne haya betach. Vahamachne haya betach. Betach, the language of like bitachon, that they weren't ready for this attack. They didn't believe, they didn't trust that Gideon was going to be able to attack them. First of all, they probably thought that it would take him a while to get there, or that he would come the main way. A whole host of reasons, but they weren't prepared for the attack. And it sounds similar to that first attack. The first attack also, we had pointed out, that Gideon kind of strategically chose a time when the watch was being changed and the guards were being shifted, and it was night. And so again, And we had discussed the question in terms of, you know, where did this military prowess, where did it come from? He didn't have a track record. They had been subdued by Midian for so many years. So probably it's the Ruach Hashem. It's the divine spirit that's coming upon the Shofet. Pasuk Yud Beis. Vayonusu Zevach v'Tzalmuna v'yirdov hachareihem. So the two kings, Zevach and Tzalmuna, they go on the run. V'yirdov hachareihem. He chases after them. He captures the two kings of Midian, Zevach and Tzalmuna, v'chol hamachaneh hecherid. And the entire camp, hecherid, became terrified, because the Midianites saw that the kings had been captured. They heard, they saw, and so this is considered to be full victory. Full victory, Pasuk Yud Gimel. By Yashav Gideon ben Yoash min ha-Malchama. he returns from the war, milmale hacharas, which is a strange phrase. Milmale hacharas. So Mitzvah Tzion says we should read the word chares as hashemesh, the sun. Milmale hashemesh, while the sun was still up. While the sun was still up, so there is a symbol there. The symbol of the sun being up is a, as previously he had attacked by night. Previously, even before that, when he was charged by Hashem to destroy the Mizbeach of Baal, he chose to do it at night. And night is a symbol of gullus, of exile, of negativity. Shemesh and light is positivity, light is geula, light is redemption. And so he comes back milmale hacharis, while the sun is still up. It's a sign of redemption. I did not see an explanation of why this phrase milmale hacharis. Why doesn't it just say, you know, like something like sun, like shemesh, or why is it an interesting, a poetic language? So I don't have an answer to that. And he was extremely successful. He has not killed the two kings. He's taken them captive. And the first thing that he's going to do is he's going to keep his word in terms of going back to Sukkos and Penuah. Pasuk Yud Dalet. Vayilkad nar me'anshei Sukkos vayishaleihu. He took hold, hopefully, you know, without actually any pain, but he took hold of one of the youths from the town of Sukkos, from the Anshei Sukkos, vayishaleihu, and he asked him. From the understanding, it seems that from the way we'll read the pasuk, it seems that he asked them for a list of who were the leaders of Sukkos, because Sukkos was not a place where, right? It was specifically this, as it was read to us, it was specifically pasuk vav. It was the sarei Sukkos. It was the officers of Sukkos, the leaders of Sukkos, who had said no to providing the provisions, and therefore they're the only ones who deserve to get some form of punishment. So he asks him, "Vayichtov elav," and he wrote to him, meaning this youth wrote to Gidon, "Es sarei Sukkos ve'esekeinah," the officers of Sukkos and the elders, "Shivim v'shiva ish." It ended up being a list of 77 people. 77 people. Pasuk tazvav, "Vayavo anshei Sukkos," and he comes and he says to these men of Sukkos, "Vayomer, hinei zevach v'tzalmuna." Behold, here are the two Midianite kings. I'm presenting them to you. Asher cheiraftem osi, that you disgraced me, Lamor, saying, Hakav zevach v'tzamuna atab yadecha, is the palm of zevach and tzamuna already now in your hands? Ki nitein la nashacha ha'ifim lechem, that we should go ahead and give to your tired men bread? Now he shows them. He says, "I was successful in capturing them." Pasuk Tazayin, Vayikach Ziknei Ha'ir. He took the elders of the city, Ves Kotzei Hamidbar, Ves Habar Kanim, and he took the thorns and the thistles that he from the desert. V'yodabahem Es Anshe Sukkos. V'yodabahem literally translates as that, like, he made known with them the Targum, the Mitzvah Sion quotes from the Targum, this, it's a reference to breaking and thrashing, meaning this is the phrase that's used to make known to say that he actually carried out the physical punishment. The language of Vayeda may be a language of making known that he was making known to them the truth that they should have acknowledged, that they should have given what they should have given the provisions, they should have trusted in Gidon, they should have trusted in Hashem, and they need to be held accountable for violating the word of the shofet. If you want to understand it as a type of morid v'malchus, you totally can. Pasuk Yud Zayin, Ves Migdal Penuel Natatz. Now the Migdal of Penuel he smashed. Vayarog Es Anshei Ha'ir, and he killed the people of the city, which is strange. Where'd that come from? Where did that come from? The Radak explains a theory that even though originally he only threatened to take down the tower, and the Radak highlights again because they put a type of bitachon, a false sense of trust into the tower, into the physical protection, as opposed to a type of faith in God. So what happened maybe was is that as Gideon came to destroy the tower, naturally people from the town tried to defend it. If they tried to defend it at that point it was fair game, and he engaged in a small battle, and men from the town unfortunately were killed. And even in that moment, if you take the Radak's thought and flesh it out, you're saying to yourself, here's Gideon. He went ahead and did what he said he was going to do. As he told the people of Penuel, Bishuvi b'shalom, he returned in peace. He's holding the two foreign kings. And now he's coming to punish by taking down the tower. So the proper person would say, we're deserving of punishment. You win. And we'll help you take down the tower. When they put forward and they fight to defend, if it's true that they were defending the tower, it's like they're still being moried in his leadership. They're not even willing to acknowledge. Now that he's been, this is almost even, maybe you would say it's spitting in Gideon's face even more. Meaning he actually did what they kind of said he would never be able to do, and still they're being defiant by putting their bodies or themselves and trying to protect the tower.
They believe that the tower is their tool, you know, that's their
strength. Could the tower have been a form of Avodah Zarah? It's definitely possible. You know, we're going to see something develop over the end of Perek Ches and then the beginning of Perek Tes that unfortunately, which is something that's so hard for us to understand, almost anything can be turned into Avodah Zarah. It's like remarkable. And at the same time, it's so hard for us to understand, we always have to keep reminding ourselves that whatever they thought of as Avodah Zarah, they had a real connection to. They developed a real connection. There was a real, quote-unquote, desire or Yetzirah for it. So it's definitely possible. It speaks to a false sense of security, which maybe you would say some of Avodah Zarah is, when you're putting your trust in an idol as opposed to Hashem, and that you can have situations of plenty of times throughout the time period in the Shoftim and beyond, the Avodah Zarah of the Jewish people isn't always that they ignore Hashem's existence altogether. It's that they incorporate Elohim Acherim, other gods, and that they, you know, almost echoing the language we had, we reviewed it in the Haftorah 2 weeks ago for Parashas Kisisa, when it was Eliyahu Bahar HaKarmel, and he turns to the Jewish people and he says, Ad Matai, until when are you going to be Al Shnei, like Poseach Al Shnei Se'ifim? When are you going to be like, you're going back both sides? You believe in Hashem, you believe in Baal. You believe in Hashem, there's no such thing as that. That's Avodah Zarah. If Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday you believe in Hashem, and Wednesday, Thursday, Friday you believe in Avodah Zarah, you're an Ovid Avodah Zarah. It's Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. There has to be a complete allegiance, and a belief that there is only one. So there's definitely this sense that they had trust, and they in him, and they had trust in their tower, and he destroys it. Pasuk Yud Ches, Vayomer El Zevach Vel Tzamuna. So now that he kind of, you know, in a certain sense, he finished show and tell with the two kings, meaning he needed Zevach and Tzamuna to stay alive in order to make a point with the people of Sukkos, with the people of Penuel. And now he's addressing them. And for us, the reader of Tanakh, this seems totally out of left field. Because he says the following to them, Eifo ha'anashim asher haragtem bisavor. Eifo is like, not just where, but like, What type? What type of men? What was the description of the men? Asher haraktem, that they killed, bitavor. Haraktem, that you killed bitavor in a place called Tavor. And so apparently there had been some type of news that had come Gidon's way, that one of the aspects that of Zevach and Salmuna during their time in Eretz Yisrael was that at one point they and maybe it was in the midst of the battle, that they had killed men from a place called Tavor. Vayomru, and they answered back to Gidon, Kamocha Kimohem, like you was like them. Echad Kisor Bnei HaMelech, like the form of the king's, like the of the king's sons. Meaning they're referring to you, they're referring to Gidon as king or as ruler. And therefore it was relatives. They had killed relatives of Gidon, and he accused them, or he at least asked them, and they admitted to doing such a thing. Now we had not read about that at all. So when did that exactly happen, and how Gidon became aware of that is going to be a question that I will join you in having, but I don't have an answer for it. It seems to be almost taken for granted that Gidon was able to find out this information, and that he then kind of interrogates them. Pasuk Yotes. Vayomar, so he says back to, he says, continuing back, Achai b'nei imihem, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother. Chai Hashem, by as Hashem lives, lu hachayisem osem, lo harakti eschem. If you had you let them live, I would let you live. Which is now the opposite is being implied as well. Now that you do not let them live, I'm not going to let you live. Now, why he would allow them to live? What would be gained? They'd be like prisoner. You know, you kind of have to play it out in your mind. What's the alternative? To let them go would not have been an option. They'd just go back to Midian and build up a force. He went after these two kings seemingly because they're part of the way to get a complete sense of peace would be for them to be out of the picture. So what does it mean to leave them alive? I don't necessarily know, but maybe you would have some type of prisoner of war where, you know, they stay in a jail cell. We have, that's the way the Tanakh actually ends. When Divrei Hayamim Beis ends, it ends with one of the kings, Tzidkiyahu, who was king in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash being destroyed. He was taken to Babel, and he was put in either Tzidkiyahu or his predecessor was put into jail, and he was put into jail for like 37 years. And then the Tanakh ends. So that was a prisoner of war. They could have killed him, and they didn't. So there is the concept, but he says to them, and we can understand that, had you let them live, I would not kill you. So now I'm going to kill you. Interesting, though, in Pasuk Chaf, Gidon chooses at least an attempt to kill them, which is a little bit out of the ordinary. Pasuk Chaf, Vayomer liYeser bechoro. He turned to Yeser, his firstborn, and said as following: Kum, get up, harogosam, and kill them. Meaning, he asks his son to be the executioner. Almost trying to initiate his son, perhaps, to be involved in matters of state. I don't know. V'lo shalaf hanar charbo ki yarei ki odanu nar. But the nar did not lift. He did not draw his sword. Ki yarei, he was afraid. Ki odanu nar. What was he afraid of? He could be afraid to kill. He could be afraid to kill in front of his father, to kind of step into that role. Maybe there are other elders there as well, people who are better suited, more, it's more honorable. So he declines. Vayomer Zevach v'Tzalmuna, and then Zevach and Tzalmuna say, meaning the two the prisoners of war themselves, the two kings of Midian, they say back to Gidon, Kum ata ufigabanu. You, Gideon, you get up, Ufigabanu, and you attack us. Ki cha'ish gevura so, for as a man is, so is his strength. Vayakim Gideon vayarog as Zevach v'tzalmuna. So Gideon got up and he killed Zevach and Tzalmuna. Vayikach as Saharonim. He took their Saharonim, which we'll explain in a minute. Asher b'tzavare gemalehem, that were on the necks of their camels. It's almost, the way the Mefarshim understand their request, they overhear Gideon asking his son to kill. And they say, no, we want you. Why do they want Gideon? So, I don't mean to make light of something that sounds like that is very serious. No one wants to be executed. But if you're going to be executed, you don't want to be executed by someone who's carrying out the execution for the first time. In the sense that they won't know what they're doing, and they may cause them extra pain. And so that was one thinking. The other thinking is, from their perspective, it's quite a disgrace for a nar to kill them, for a lad to kill them. And maybe that was part of Gideon's thinking, that it's almost honorable. It's honorable for a fellow pseudo-king, as we're understanding Gideon. We're talking about ideas of Morid B'malchus, well, he was the shofi, he's the ruler. They refer to him a certain way, right? They use that word B'nei HaMelech, referring to a likeness to him as Melech, as a type of king. And so it's more honorable to be executed by the king. I mean, obviously, that's a foreign idea to us. But there's some level of respect that if you're going to be killed, it should be the general who kills you. It's like that. So they almost make that request of, and that might be what, you know, the Mefarshim may see that within the phrase ki cha'ish gevura so, for as a man so is his strength. On the one hand, they wanted Gideon's physical strength to carry out the execution so it would be quick and painless. And also, ish kegvura so, the power, the might. And ish also sometimes described as almost from a position of importance. Gideon does it. And the pasuk ends, vayikaches saharonim. So I was probably about 20 years ago when I learned the word sahar. What's a sahar? Sahar is a crescent moon. It's a crescent moon. How did I learn the word? One of my Israeli cousins had a baby boy and named him Sahar. I had no idea what the word meant because it's not a common name, but it's under the category of those Israeli names that they use there and not here. It's a crescent moon. It's the shape of the moon when it's brand new, right? We have Rosh Chodesh coming up. I don't think so. I don't remember why. I think I stopped at the what. I was like just puzzled. And now I think he's probably passed. I think he even finished the army already. So it's a while ago. Sahar. So Asaronim, there were crescent shapes that they had on the necks of their camels, which was some type of ornament. And that Gideon's taking of it is almost it's a sign of being victorious. That these crescents were some type of symbol of leadership that Midian had. Whether or not it somehow, you know, we know that in Islam there is a symbol. Is the roots there? I don't know. Who would know such a thing? Like an anthropologist or some type of I'm not a historian to know what are the origins of the crescent, but it was already in biblical times. It was something. It was within Midian, and they would keep it on the necks of their camels. And so having it is considered to be rather significant.
So why did you kill them on the battlefield? Why did you bring them back to Sukkot and Penuel just to show?
So the question is why bring them? Why not kill them on the battlefield? So you may. There are two models with when you capture the general. There is a model to and unfortunately it's a little bit graphic, but you know, in biblical times things were sometimes, unfortunately things are graphic today too. You just have to look at the news. But there's almost like beheading, And then you bring back the head. And you kind of display the head in the sense of showing that victory. It seems that, first of all, you might say, if we take his words in Pasuk Yates, if we take them literally, he was ready to keep them alive. I mean, he said that had you not treated my family poorly, I would have kept you alive. Now, with the understanding being that now that I know that you treated them so poorly and killed them, I'm going to kill you or have you be killed. So maybe his plan was always to keep them alive. It could also be that I guess you could ask yourself the question, which is more impactful when he's talking to the people of Sukkos and the people of Penuel, to have the two Midianite kings alive or to have them dead? I probably hear both ways, because you were saying I wasn't going to be able to capture them. Here, I have proof that they're dead. Or you were saying I wasn't going to be able to capture them. I have them alive. I'm in control of them. I'm in control of the situation. Maybe it's more impactful. You know, they can say who they are. He could say, you know, he could give them the mic and say, like, say your name. I'm King Zevach. I'm King Tzalmunna. Maybe it's more dramatic if he has them alive in terms of what he was trying to accomplish there. And in the back of our minds is maybe this concept that maybe he did want to keep them alive. Or maybe he didn't think that he needed to put them to death. As long as he captured them, as long as he removed them from their camp of 15,000, as we saw, once he removes them, even without killing them, the Pasuk had kind of testified about the camp that the whole camp is afraid. The whole camp is afraid. Presumably they disperse, and the threat of Midian is no longer. Now, Gideon is wildly successful as a leader, and in terms of the episode that happens in Penuel and in Sukkos, it also speaks to, you know, how is everyone else in the country going to react to that? First and foremost, you're probably going to be afraid of Gideon. You're going to take what he said. First of all, you're going to listen to his threats, and he has a certain sense of real power and leadership, and the Tanakh is not critical of what he did in terms of that. And so there may be an aspect that what he did was the right thing, and therefore he's showing real leadership, and the people are going, as we'll see, the people become enamored with his form of leadership, and they want to attach themselves to it. It could be from a non-healthy place, and maybe we'll continue there. We'll stop here and we'll continue with Pasuk Chaf Beis, God willing, next time.